Okay, so as the title says, I'm looking at knots in random fields. A better title is probably knots in random eigenfunctions for reasons I'll go into later, but then I lose the visual pun, which I didn't feel I'd had enough of so far. I don't want to spend too long overall on the talk. It's nice results, there's some mildly interesting analytic stuff. Mostly I just want to introduce the idea of looking for knots in these random eigenfunctions. So the big thing is something Mark did a few years ago with in collaboration with guys at Glasgow was looking in random optical fields, which is the model, for tracing the vortex lines in a periodic cell and trying to find, well, for a start, any topologically interesting things, links or whatever, but knots was the ideal goal. And they never quite managed to do that. They found links, they found some interesting statistics, but knots were always out of reach, which is the thing that we've now rectified. So I'll talk about both their physical model and the physical model that we're using now, which is a little different and more tractable in many ways. I'll talk about detecting vortex lines, which is kind of the big jump between doing it the way that was previously done, which is, you know, fairly crude and it might have worked, but it turned out not to, and the more trying to be clever about it, because you really can't compute everything you might hope to. And of course, some results and a lot of questions which I still have for the future, and maybe some of you have to know the answer to. The image on the right there is, you know, it's just a sample of, if you take these random eigenfunctions, vortex lines that make these complex tangles. And the question is, are any of those knotted? The answer there is no, but we have to do something larger to find that. So this is the way the guys in Glasgow did it. They were doing it, it's a, sort of a semi-physical model of an actual optical beam. So they start with the image on the top right and bottom right are k-space graphs. So they just have a grid of vectors in k-space.
Light the example of what actually the sort of function we're talking about. So everybody's clear what model. So you're not speaking just like an optical physicist.
Yeah, as in write the Helmholtz equation down.
No, I write the superposition. Flag it while we're talking.
Yes. Do that.
Yeah, I did notice the talk had the title and the author's of you with supervised by Mark, but I think it's happening right now.
Yeah. That's okay. Okay, all is fine. Okay. So they took a case basically. We modulated the intensity with the Gaussian, gave it random phase, and propagated it, and it's periodic by the Talbot effect. So, you know, it's a simple model for something you really could do in an experiment. And I think they did experiments with basically this setup and found basically the same kind of vortex lines. You can... The problem with the model is, although it's, it can be compact in X and Y, by the nature of the Talbot effect, it's incredibly extended in Z. So, like Mark's mentioned before, the knots that he made in beams, paraxial beams, you know, they can be millimeters in X and Y, but, you know, much more like a meter in Z, which is fine for some things, but it's not ideal when all you really want to do is just look at the general topology. But in any case, you can track them by the 2π phase change around them, or in principle multiples of 2π, but in reality you only really see 2π. And just as a statistic of the kind of model they had, if you took a plane through their data, you might find 250 vortices in a plane with 600 by 600 grid points. But yeah, I'll come back to that later. I need to write it down.
So can I just ask, are people happy what the model that we're looking at is? So we have a superposition of plane waves. I've written A sub k e to the I k dot r. And in the pattern that Sandy's been talking about, we're propagating according to the two-dimensional Schrodinger equation, as it turns out, appropriate for laser beams, with the z-direction like time. So we're tracing that out deterministically. But then looking at this distribution of these k-vectors, the wave vectors, we assign those on grid points, but then they have a value, amplitude, ak, whose intensity is roughly modulated to look like, well, a Gaussian modulating Gaussian noise, and the phase, the argument, is also a random
possibility. The phase is in like C star, R2 star, it's two dimensional?
Yeah, so in this case it's two dimensional.
Is everyone clear? Great. So this is essentially the kind of results they get. So that's one of their cells. Yeah, the units are kind of arbitrary, but you get this elongated thing. The vortices in the center are clearly massively tangled. There's nothing you can really say just by looking at the image. You can't even really, you can sort of say here, say it's a single vortex loop, but it's pretty small. That one's clearly not knotted. And then these much larger ones, the color's not great, but you can see all this dark color here. That's actually all one vortex, which just winds massively through the cell. And it turns out it isn't a loop. It comes back to its starting point in a different one of these periodic cells. So it's an infinite periodic line.
Non-trivial homology in the three torus.
Yes.
What? Who's that?
It means it doesn't. It comes back to the same point in a different cell.
But is it not?
Well, how can you define knotting for an infinite periodic line? That's
my question to you.
Well, that's also my question to you.
Your questions have been floating around.
Okay, you can do obvious things like, you can just take ideas from proteins or whatever, like Ken Millett was talking about. You can say, oh, you take a periodic segment and you take the endpoints to points in a sphere a long distance away, and if you move the point along the sphere, what fraction of the time is it knotted, and whatever. But it's all kind of arbitrary, and I think it's an open question as to how you can really talk about this in a useful way, but I don't want to linger on that now. The most interesting topologically things they could find were things like this. I don't think they found anything more than three looped tangles. This is just an image from one of their papers. There were lots of smaller links, two-component links. But you can see this. None of these things are knotted, and you have to go a step further to actually find knots. The one thing that perhaps is somewhat interesting here is you can look at the fractal dimensions of the way the lines scale, yeah, however you like, really. This is a Pythagorean distance, which is, well, I won't do this. It's one of the many ways of measuring fractal scaling. And the gradient there is 0.52, extremely consistent with the 0.5 you expect of Brownian random walks, which supports the kind of the general idea that these vortices probably are random walks on a large scale. But it's another somewhat open question as to exactly whether they're random walks and on what level that breaks down, which perhaps I can shed some light on.
Are you sure that, wait, so when you say that it's Brownian, you mean in that tangle?
Yes.
So you could be probing the Palmer Milk limit.
I guess so, yeah.
Sure. So we're looking, I said this in my talk as well, what we're looking at is, of course, there's a particular short correlation length scale in this. It comes from the correlation length scale of the random wave that gives rise to it. We're larger than any correlation length scales, just like when you're looking at polymer melts.
No, polymer melts are much more remarkable because polymers that, when they're by themselves, actually swell up. When they go into a melt in the semi-dilute regime, they actually screen themselves.
Okay, there's no screening. So if you take a slice and look at just in two dimensions, there looks like the screening depends on the orientation of the lines going through. So there's screening of two lines with the same orientation, that is to say, they look like they repel, but there's no particular correlation that you can pin down if they're if their orientation is opposite to each other. These guys can get as close as they like to each other. There's not a repulsion distance.
Are you happy?
We can talk about it. I think this is how to tie in this idea of this 2D to really what's happening in 3D is something that we would like to understand more from the polymer approach.
So we'll talk about it later. But yeah, this is kind of a snapshot of the limit of that previous work. They found a few links. They established a few statistics about scaling, but that's kind of where it stopped. And it was never a main project, I think. It's only some previous results. So that moves on to the way we did it instead. Rather than messing around with any of this physical, you know, propagating paraxially and so on, as long as the model is somewhat physical, we don't really want to make an experiment doing it. We don't care about the actual topology. So we can abandon that and just use solutions of the Helmholtz equation, which, you know, is a physical equation describing light fields. And in fact, if you just use a sum of Gaussian random plane waves with random phases, that's a standard model of a chaotic eigenfunction.
So in answer to Rob's question before, we're now sampling it on the sphere rather than, and we're not propagating. These are now stationary solutions of the time independent drinking equation.
Yes, and this so this defines your 3D field in a 3D periodic. But again, it's periodic using this along the L parameter. So if you want to take some particular numbers, 100 plane waves gives apparently random vortex lines. Certainly you can't distinguish them from non-random vortex lines. E, say you use 225 or L is 15, happens to be a... It's what we've used, and the parameters, there are still some questions as to how things scale with them and so on, but I won't linger on it. So what you get, you know, I'm sure you've all seen pictures of optical spec or whatever before, you get a random looking intensity pattern, and the vortex lines are passed through these dark points, marked in color, denotes their orientation, their rotation direction. And the same phase pattern, you know, clearly, these are where the vortex lines pass through the field.
And I should say, Randy, the correlations for this model are a lot stronger. There's a lot more rigid correlation structure associated with these three-dimensional way of satisfying the Helmholtz equation than the previous one.
Okay, so before anything else, I want to say you can do a little bit of analytic stuff with this model. And you can't just get an equation for vortex lines. You know, if you can, no one knows how. But something that Mark and Michael Berry did, again a couple of years ago, is look at the reconnections and these small loops. So if you modify the parameters slightly, you see these small loops kind of nucleate and grow. And the direct math isn't particularly relevant. But what you end up with is an equation for a plane describing what the loops lie on, or the reconnection lines lie on if you have a different matrix parameter, along with an equation for either an ellipse or a hyperbola. So that's basically telling you that anywhere where your vortex line almost reconnects with itself is described by this, which is it's kind of a limit on its curvature and so on. Or where a loop is small, you expect to see it in this shape. So it's one thing that we can check in a minute, that the model actually fulfills. Unless anyone has any particular questions, I don't want to linger on the way it actually works.
No, I'm just saying, the point being here is because these satisfy the wave equation, they are smooth at the small scale. So we're not seeing the randomness here. This is the small scale cutoff behavior.
What does gamma perp mean?
I was hoping no one would ask me that question.
I love the capital C to this.
I think it's awful. I intended to change the font, but it comes back to this matrix here in the original. You expand around the point, you get second derivative and first derivative. So that's the xx, yy, xy, and yx components.
So we pick a frame. So if you look at the left-hand side, so this is looking at a parameterization. As, like in Ivo's talk, when he had these very small loops that were appearing, this is trying to understand the structure of that cone in four-dimensional space as this zero shrinks down. And this is the typical behavior, assuming that these functions are generic. So there's a sort of, it projects to an ellipse, but it's a slightly more complicated curve in three dimensions.
We can show you later if you're interested. So what I want to talk about now is briefly the way we actually track things, because this is kind of the step beyond just, you know, looking for two by phase changes and joining them together, and trying to be more clever. So because I didn't have time to make a big load of pictures, I was going to just make it go, and you can see it. So you start off by just, you know, you define your grid in three-dimensional space over the entire periodic cell. You find each point, you find its phase, and then around each subcube in the cell, I'm not sure if it is a technical term, for every side of that cube, you can check for two-by phase change around it. And any cube that has, you know, one anti-clockwise and one clockwise phase change, you know, there's a vortex going through it, and you can join those two ends up. But then you have to be a bit more clever, because what that doesn't do is tell you what happens, say, if two vortex lines go into the same cell, or even more complex things, and less obvious stuff, like if two cells next to each other appear not to interact, they may actually, if a vortex goes through the slide twice, you can't detect that, regardless of the vortex orientation. So trying to be more clever again, because we know the wave function of the field, you can just calculate it again at any point. You can go back and forth to the cell, and wherever there's any doubt at all what's happening, or even where there might be some doubt, if you're at all suspicious, you can regenerate that data in a high resolution and join it all together and make sure you're right. And at the end, you join all these lines together and you find that out of 90,000 cells in the entire grid, 15,000 of them had something happening in them. And in 2,600 or so, you had to actually go to a higher resolution than initial. And that 65 is a rough number on the increasing resolution you needed, and the number of times you need to increase resolution beyond the previous research that's been done. So that's the general idea of why this is more interesting than the previous preaxial stuff. And in this statistic I can go back to, previously they had 250 in a 600 by 600 cross section. You can do it much faster using 150 by 150 for the same number of vortices, but zooming in on the points that are interesting, and overall it's much faster, which is important because it's really hard to find a knot. So before getting on to knots, let's talk about this small scaling stuff I showed you with the analytics. Actually turns out to be amazingly obvious if you start graphing any statistics of the vortex scaling and that kind of thing. So on the left is a radius of duration of a loop, and you can see that I don't think anyone can argue there's a sudden gradient cutoff there, a distance corresponding to roughly 3 when L is 15, if you remember, in the periodic cell. And if you graph things below that, you see the vortices, they really do make these slightly warped ellipses, and those are the graphs before. And they have the scaling there, the gradient is 1, which is again what you expect of such ellipses. There's nothing complex about it. Whereas afterwards, the gradient jumps to 0.53, again, the random walk scaling. Although you have to use the right random walk if it's on a grid, it's self-avoiding, whatever. But again, it's all consistent with the previous work and with what you might expect. And on the right, just a very crude writhing measure. So rather than measuring the true writhe, the average of the writhe over all the orientations of the curve, if you just take a random plate and you have enough curves, you still get some fairly good data. And you can see again, there's a definite cutoff where things switch between that basic behavior and something more complex, which seems to be a random walk. But then, that was where we were stuck for a while, several weeks certainly. But thanks for being here with all you excellent people, we found some knots. But they're not obvious. I don't know if anyone can, any of you eagle-eyed tutorials, can you tell me what knots these are? They both have 5 or fewer crossings. Anyone else? The one on the left is a trefoil, and the one on the right is an unknot. Thank you, Robert. I was really hoping.
The colour scheme was dismissed. It looked like you thought that they were at least more than tri-colourable.
I thought this one actually wrapped around. I thought it was like a twist presentation.
So it's very hard to tell. If there was a slightly, if two lines are switched here, whether the knot will be something different. And it's frankly difficult to get it right. But you know, making it actually work. And we can only do the Alexander polynomial at -1. I can show you some actual examples of statistics. Because these are so massive, you know, even this smallest, this is the one left is the smallest knot I've found. Its length is 407. Again, units for the periodic cell, it's only 15 long. So it goes through many, many of these cells. At best, you can take it down to 1,000. It has 1,000 crossings in that projection. If you just apply random isomers 1 and 2, and you know, slightly more than that, if you're a bit clever, you can still only get it to 100. And maybe you can do that symbolically, but you're kind of pushing the limits of certainly the things I've tried. But you can see the Alexander polynomial -1 is 3, because that's very easy to find. So it's almost certainly a trefoil. Unfortunately, these bigger ones are far, far more complex. And the one in the middle, you can't get that down fewer than a few thousand crossings. So again, you can only do it at -1. And when you get 15 out, you're not sure if that's 3 times 5. So it could be a trefoil composed of the figure 8. Or I think there are several larger knots than the polynomial minus 1 is the same. And even if you think you've got that sorted, like you try and cleverly cut the knot into pieces and try and find a bit that's a trefoil and a bit that's a figure 8, when you get to these very, very big ones, this has 50,025. So you can decompose it to prime factors, which could be the individual knot, so it could be something more complicated, and we don't yet know. And again, you've got 11,000 crossings you have to put into your Alexander polynomial finding algorithm, so if anyone knows a way of doing that Savorkia, I'd be delighted to know. Unfortunately, right now, we...
What was the last question?
Sorry?
What was the question you just asked?
So if anyone knows a program where you can give it 11,000 crossings, say, as a Gauss code, and it can tell you what Alexander polynomial is.
I think the most efficient algorithm for computing the Alexander polynomial is a recent paper of Drobar and Tanz.
Mm-hmm.
It's a polynomial time algorithm, but it's.
Well, yeah, you're limited by reality. Yeah. So, I will.
Can't you just make the curve smoother in 3D before projecting it? Yeah.
You can, but then how sure are you that you aren't losing any? Topology.
You advance them by one cell size, slowly, and so.
So you could, but that would, if you're doing a lot of operations, it's itself complex to move the whole curve around and be sure you're not losing anything. Like it takes a couple of minutes to find this 50,025. So it's something I'm looking at certainly, but you have to be quite careful. And maybe it will be possible. We'll see.
It's only just got it to work.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago I found these. And I found loads because I just got the minus one thing working. So, one more slide. These are all the knots I've found so far in terms of loop length and the Alexander polynomial at minus one. What you'd really want to find is the unknotting half-life. So, if you plot the probability of being an unknot against the length of the loop, you're going to find some exponential curve. And that exponent is characterized by a half-life. Which is very characteristic of the kind of curve it is, but there's simply not enough data to do that. The reason the pointer clusters at the top and the bottom here, at the bottom there are 277,000 small loops, which just really have no chance of being knotted. They're simply not large enough. And as soon as you get big enough, suddenly you jump to finding they're all knotted, so you need a lot more data around that 1,000, 2,000 point. But in the meantime, these ones, that's a log of the Alexander minus 1, so e to the 14. It's a massive number. So anything you manipulate, like any way of manipulating that curve is difficult and requires some thought. But that's it. That's where we are. There are a lot of questions still open. Some of them we can start answering now. Again, some of them I don't know if people already know the answers to. The most obvious is, what are the actual knot polynomials? Are these really compositions of many small knots, or much more complex 50 crossing knots, whose no one really knows what their polynomials are. Are they really random walks? We know there are limits on their random walk nature because of this small scale stuff that has to be true. But on a large scale, do they really scale exactly the right way or slightly wrong? And that's an open question which I guess is addressable with more data. We want to know these half-lives again. Linking I haven't done yet, but it's relatively simple, so we expect to find a lot of them. Perhaps we can find the half-life, the unlinking, rather than the unknotting. As before, we can ask if these periodic infinite lines are knotted. And again, it's a question of choosing a measure of knottedness.
John answered it.
Ryan seems to be. Have I missed the answer to this question?
Yeah, that's a good question. See if it's isotopic to a linear.
Right.
Not in homology.
Right, every homology class is a unique linear representative of the translation. Yeah. So.
Okay, so we'll do that.
That's your standard.
So you've done that, though. I mean, you know what homologies are of these. You know how many boxes
So you can take basic data like that, but we can talk about it. I was not aware of a way of taking very much information about these from what I know, but I could just be missing.
So the difference between the unknot that sits inside the cell and one that goes across?
There's a straight line. I worked in the homology class, even a Zeifert annulus that's embedded that goes between that line.
This was meant for ones that are non-trivial homologically.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
What if they sit inside the periodic box? So that's, again, the economy, is that, but is that useful?
For what?
Each element of H1, then you have to have some determinant element of H1.
So there's the unknot, which sits inside the solute. And then there's something that loops around, goes in and out of the box.
Right, they're distinct.
They're distinct?
Yes.
Okay. But if you have a bigger box, they might not be distinct anymore, right?
Well, the box is periodic, right? So that would be a non-trivial homological.
Right, but suppose that he's simulating a bigger box.
Mm-hmm. Then I have to find that order.
Suppose he's simulating a bigger box.
Right.
Then the thing you're talking about
might
actually come back around on itself inside the box.
So, of course, that's the question, because, of course, for physicists, we just impose periodic boundary conditions for convenience, not because we're fundamentally interested in the homology of the three torus.
Okay.
But then the question we would like to be able to answer is, by understanding how these things would not, with non-trivial homology in the three torus, is there a way of then seeing how that is a sort of finite size effect in the sense of something that really is random in a bigger box, as Randy says? Is there some topological difference between these random curves with non-trivial homology or not?
Once it's non-trivial and it's small, it's infinite order class.
If we were to take this system like this, and rather than looking at the k's that lie on the intersection of the two sphere with a lattice, which ensures that we're periodic in this three torus, if we were to really sample just on the sphere, so we have an genuinely infinite system, the question is, would there be any infinitely long lines with probability 1? Or with probability 1, would all of the lines be zero level sets closed?
Right.
So that's a question that we'd quite like to be able to answer.
And since he's doing it in the torus, right, you have this problem that you can't distinguish between the two.
Yeah, but as soon as the system's finite, it's got non-trivial homology whether or not it's a section of a larger loop that's larger than the box, or whether it's a section of a line that really doesn't close.
So why are you doing it on the torus?
Because you can't simulate an infinite box.
It's preferable to... these loops are massive, right? The knots that we've actually found in this periodic model go through many boxes.
Right.
If you wanted to not use a periodic model, you'd have to use an incredibly large grid to get.
You could simulate something that's a little bit more infinite by using like a cusped hyperbolic manifold or something.
Why don't you just look at spherical harmonics in the three sphere or something, right? You could take sort of random combinations of those, and that would give you some, you know, random eigenfield in a compact, well, you know, in the three sphere, where you know sort of what knotting is. I don't know, is this crazy or?
Other people are doing that, and we've agreed not to.
Okay, well.
Have you tried to talk to people who do preparations?
Yes.
What do they say? Do they?
Different people say different things.
I'm not aware of any profound ideas from percolation affecting.
So there's a standard thing about random.
Mathematics bands. Is very difficult.
Well, it's not quite percolation in a. Because
yeah, but your. I just mentioned that because your images make me think of percolation. You see that sort of random loop which looks like a curve where you know. You would flip a coin or an octagonal dice or whatever 20,000 times, and at each flip you would turn left, right, up, straight, back, or whatever, and an image like that emerges, and then you can ask legitimate mathematical questions.
So this is
what is the probability that with n splits all the dice, well, giving you six or whatever number.
There's a guy at UBC that studies this, Andrew Rechnitzer.
Yeah, so this has been studied quite a lot in a two-dimensional random wave system. So people who are interested in these random dynamical systems feel more comfortable in 2D. And then you look at one of the, rather than this being a complex function, real random functions. And then
I'm not aware of anyone who would do something like that in a three-dimensional.
No, not in three-dimensional, but in a two-dimensional, there's quite a lot.
Andrew Rechnitzer at UBC.
Who?
Andrew Rechnitzer at UBC.
But then the particular question with the percolation of the nodal domains, that is to say, looking at the connected components of where these random functions are positive, it turns out to be exactly in the domain where it's hard to say anything strong about percolation, because the correlations are just strong enough that you have to worry, but not strong enough that you can say for sure that something's going on. So there's quite an argument about precisely how to invoke the Harris criterion in order to deal with percolation, whereas this physicist's way to try and, in the 2D case, but then the 3D case, it's not even, you can't even really directly map it onto a percolation model in a way that we can compare to anything strong. But it's a good question, that's exactly what the link with these things we're trying to make.
So, really, all these questions are things I would be very interested in discussing.
Well, this might be very different from what we have here. This might be very different from what happens in 2D.
Yeah, so...
2D, the ground in motion is fundamentally different in 2D and 3D.
That's why we're looking at the 3D case.
In 2D, it's everything. It's probability 1. In 3D, that's not.
So, we can go through here and then... I guess we can continue. This picture at the bottom, this is a picture of one of these periodic lines. So the colors go red through purple through blue, and the red end, I think in this case, one cell along from itself. But you can see it passes through many different ones of these periodic cells if a single radius is this far. And there are quite a lot of these because they're perhaps a property of the doing things in a torus. So if you could do some interesting measure of knottiness on them, that would be useful because there's a lot more data about them. They're far more common than these loops. In fact, one way to look at the loops, I think, is occasionally one of these will join up with itself, and that's what these longest loops are. They're always a very short step away from being a periodic line and a small loop. So then we can continue asking, we can say, can we describe Bosic lines analytically? And the whole thing, perhaps not, but perhaps it's possible to go better than the brief analytics I showed earlier. And another question we're very interested in are these statistics persistent if you put this in a nonlinear system? So I guess in the simplest case, if you took one of these periodic starting boxes and put it into a nonlinear equation and propagated it through time, do the knots in statistics change? Do they stay the same? Do the knots disappear? I don't know, but perhaps we can find out. And that's all, so thank you.
So the random here is k, right?
Well, k's, say we look at what Sandy was talking about. The k's all lie on this intersection of a Z3 lattice with the 2-sphere. 2-sphere because that's what makes it satisfy the Helmholtz equation. This Z3 lattice, because that's the Fourier transform of a 3-torus.
But it's a big 2-sphere, so certain rational points,
exactly.
Got it. Okay.
But yeah, so and then the idea is as look at higher and higher energies, you get more and more points.
It's a number theory question. So to get a particular period in the actual knot, the Fourier transform, involves some condition on what combination you have.
So we haven't looked too deeply into the number theory of this, but we just go run through all the numbers and look for ones which can be written as the sum of squares in as many different ways as you can find.
Interesting. You showed that the chances of being something that represents a homology class is something that's somehow a distribution of irrational
Because we're looking at linear properties and linear waves, there is an intimate relationship between the function and its Fourier transform. But of course, the Fourier transform is an extremely non-local measure of any local properties of the function. So if there was a way of identifying what features of the Fourier transform give you a particular knotted zero line in the function, then that would be.
That's very true, but I'm not sure about what the period. The period that you're seeing is encoded in the rational number.
It's also the choice of the random complex, normally distributed random complex numbers AK that weight each of these lattice points.
Yeah.
So somehow, yeah, it is in there, but I don't have any idea on how to extract the homology of the zero level sets from these patterns. I mean, I don't.
You should be able to get the probability distribution that you're in there for the homology. That's what I was suggesting.
Well, homology, but a single cell has got lots of different loops with different homologizers.
Each of these things you get represents an element of H1 of the three parts, depending on what it's period.
Each of the zero level sets, and then several level sets in every realization.
Can I ask a different question? Back to you guys.
All right. So I can imagine telling you what a curve is. All right, I could give you, for instance, suppose I have trefoil. I could give you a parameterization of the trefoil in terms of its curvature and its torsion, right? Friendly stereo thing, and I can imagine. So you could give me that locally, right? And you know, William knows how to do this, right? He can fly in his head. He can fly in a trefoil knot. I bet you've never done that. But you know, you could, and so you could fly a trefoil knot, or any knot, even an unfilable knot, right? As far as I can tell, right? And so you fly like this. So now the problem is you're in the torus, all right? You're not in R3, you're in T3, all right? But you still make all the maneuvers, right? So you still think from your point of view, you don't know it's periodic, okay? Right? So from your point of view, you're flying around and you still make the same trefoil, right? But now you can see how, so you might want to say that's the same knot, right? Even if one of them might have been a small one that fit entirely inside the T3, and the other one might have gone out and come back in, but you somehow want to call it the same knot, right?
So that was Sandy's example, was exactly that we're talking about the same knot if it returns to the, if we think of the T3 as tiling all of space.
Right, then
we're coming back to the same point in that three space, rather than coming back to another point, which just happens to be a translate by these steps of L
right.
away from it. So it's identifying more curves as compact.
But maybe that's not. Maybe
I think all the curves you're describing are null homologous.
They're all null homologous. They're not homotopic even.
Why?
Well, because they, I mean, if you look to the universal cover, which is R3, and you just...
Oh, I see.
I mean, the ones they're talking about, these infinite lines, you know, you just keep on flying, you know, on average in some direction.
I see.
Right, so no matter the size of your torus, they're no homotopic.
I see.
So an example of the sort of curve, so this is the question about, I guess, topology of the three torus rather than random knots, but I mean, the sort of curve that I normally think of that's problematic is something like...
It's like a whitehead wolf.
Something like that.
Right.
So I come in here, come out of the top.
Right.
So we're not claiming that it'd be isotopic to the trefoil. It's just this homologically tripping. Right, homotopically tripping.
See, that
I see.
Doesn't seem to be, I can't isotop that to that. So that's got a trivial homology, the purple one. But so it's got a non-trivial homology, but it's not knotted in the class of curves of that non-trivial homology, whereas somehow I want to say this white one is.
Right.
You do know the structures of molecules.
So returning to, I guess, was it John's definition that you should think of one of these knots in some non-trivial homology class as being knotted if it's not isotopic to a linear representative?
Yeah.
Is there, you know, a computational way of extracting that from the sort of data that Sandy already is sitting on top of?
So that's a question. But ultimately, I guess what Sandy, you're doing is you're when it comes down to it, you've got a whole bunch of crossing data, but you're wanting to encode that crossing data into some sort of not polynomial by the usual methods. But then, is there an Alexander polynomial for curves like that? And if so, you know, what's
the thing? This is like braids. It's almost like you would compare it to a braid. One from one side to the other.
But it's really, I mean, that is, but it's really kind of graded.
Yeah, that's just a simple example of the whole class of
things. The complement of that knot has a fundamental group, and that fundamental group more or less determines that knot, and it will be different than for the linear one.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So then the question is, what are the invariants of the fundamental group we can try to compute?
I see. Well, again, since it's a complete invariant, anything you extract out of it would, you know, be a useful thing to
do. In the spirit of the Alexander polynomial, probably the first thing you could do is look at torsion invariants and cyclic branch covers. That's
so that's what we have.
Okay. But there isn't a Alexander polynomial for that because it just doesn't act. It's not homologically, because it's homologically non-trivial.
Yeah. It was a rhetorical question.
Oh, okay.
Like there can't be one, or you don't know one.
Yeah, there is. You don't have a. There isn't the right kind of human cover.
The Alexander polynomial is a statement about the homology of the infinite cyclic cover of the non-constant.
But still, you have a. Actually, maybe.
You could just take the universal abelian cover, and there would be like some kind of. But I don't know how interesting it would be.
Well, I think anything that would allow them to distinguish, you know, two of these different, two of these infinite lines would be interesting.
Yes.
Okay, it sounds like you want it to be sort of quickly computable rather than.
It would be interesting. Maybe, but in this, to understand these systems, it would want to be.
And another question is, how do you even specify this? If I want to over the phone to tell you to draw this, what's the code? Because it's not the Gauss code anymore.
Right.
Isn't there a difference? If I take the line, the straight line that represents the homology class, and you think that there's a Seifert surface that co-bounds that line with the knot, and you think that.
I don't know.
If I take the straight line in the same homology class as the knot, bring it them oppositely, it's now homology. The union of those, the sum of those is homology.
Oh.
There's an embedded orientable surface
that
co-bounds them.
Yeah.
Right, but how canonical is that? You could probably isotope the one thing quite a bit with respect to, say, a fixed line.
Well, I was just trying to cook up a geometric picture of a cyclic cover, which it's not the universal abelian cover, but there's a cyclic cover.
This picture is this thing is really inside a whole box of other ones.
How do you mean? So yes, this is one line from a data set which contains many lines.
I'm saying, this is a box. There's a box here, and 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 a box here. So really, there's a whole array of these that are translates of each other, with each of which has these two points starting in the box. So maybe this whole tangle is just made up of translates of that one curve. It's not, but it could be.
The next problem is then, how do you know that such an object doesn't link itself when it comes there and back again? please.
Going back to the thing I said about the melt, right? So this idea in the melt is that when you have polymer everywhere, you have no idea how long you are. Okay? You don't know, are you interacting with your own tail or are you interacting with somebody else? Right? And so as a result, the independence becomes how the path scales with the number of steps becomes trivial. It just has a length, scale associated with it. And that, so you always go back over to random walks, right? Even if one chain in isolation, right, is all swollen, once you don't know yourself from another polymer, then you don't swell anymore.
So, Sandy, could you show one of those, the knots that you were showing me yesterday, which has this, because this is what one of the things we see that these zero lines are filling on the little 3D rotation.
Sure.
But one of the things is that we know that these lines, this tangle, sort of uniformly fills the box. The question is what is what's part of the same component?
So you have to the whole box, though?
The box, that's, well, one of your knots with the 3D.
Yeah.
The what you see is you see some patches where it sort of fills all of the space around you, and others it's just a more or less straight strand that's threading through volumes of space which contain others.
What is this that you're running?
Is it Python?
But you stole the look and feel of Mathematica.
I didn't make it.
I guess all rejections.
Can you explain who they are? And can they stay some distance apart?
So this is what you're saying, Randy. In a way, this looks a bit like this polymer melt, but there's some patches of it that look like this one curve densely fills space. For other regions, it sort of just threads through, and presumably there are other components
right
around there.
Yeah, but the this thing is talking to itself as much as it's talking to the other components.
Sure.
It can't tell the difference between itself.
It can't tell the difference between itself. Exactly. So in that sense, the question is, that's why we think that these are examples of this class of random knots that people look at. For example, like Rob was talking about Jason Cantarella's model, where you're growing some sort of Brownian random curve, and then given that it has some Brownian behavior, what's its topological properties? But there isn't enough data yet to see whether that is these are in that have the same properties as the others.
So an invariant that would be easy to compute for these is take the complement of one of these knots in the three torus, and then you could so that's a manifold of boundary. You can double it to make a closed manifold, and then you have tri-zero invariants, which are very computable for that. So the software, I'm an author on this package, Regina, and it has a very effective way of computing tri-zero invariants in a closed manifold. Two copies glued identically on the boundary.
Take the product, the interval will take its boundary.
Yes.
Say it's all. Take the product with the interval.
The product with the interval.
And take the boundary of that.
Yeah. So it looks like two copies of the knot complement stuck together along
with one more boundary motion.
Oh, I see. That means okay. It's okay.
Yeah. So that's those are invariants that are very computable, and you can get to them algorithmically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yes.
That's one. That's the periodic box which you search to find the knot.
And that's a closed loop.
Yeah.
What does the color stand for?
Of the loop. It's just colored along its length, you know, red through yellow through blue through red.
Color circle.
Yeah, just a color. Just to let you see, maybe if the red interacts with the green, you can see it's different parts of the loop. And I mean, if it's all red, you can't really see it, especially on the projector. So there's nothing profound there.
So one of the things, since you mentioned, Jason. So Jason Carolla's model was not so much to generate single Brownian appearing curves, but families of curves with fixed length, in this case, a fixed number of edges, large, but that somehow explore space of knots.
Well, I think that's the idea. So that when people are doing random walks, normally the question they want to do is they want to grow a random walk of a certain complexity of a fixed length. So like Shura would talk about where all of random polygons where all of the edges have the same length and they all so, and Ken was talking about that as well.
Let me finish the I was just a preface before the comma. It was a comma, not a semicolon or a period or a wiki semicolon or a dash or a bracket. So the statistics of a single one doesn't make sense, but the point of Jason's method was to have a large group action that preserves sort of a measure on the space of polygons, and that lets you sort of make sense of what it means to be sort of distributed in there. And so the question is whether, and so like one of the things they asked about was like expected values of certain quantities, like edge length, statistics of the sample. You can't extract it from a single object, but you can ask about some average property in single objects. Is there any information that comes out of, if I go through the sample of k's, that's wrong, you can extract certain statistics from one.
So you mean uniformly sample all the k's and open up again and of all the curves and all of those.
So Grossberg had this thing about for equilateral ones that the expected total curvature was, the number of edges times pi root 2 plus 3/8 pi. So not that that's interesting. It can come at 3/8 by the surplus curvature. And for other models, Jason's model is conjectured to be pi over 4. But just think, what kind of
some statistic. I haven't done that in particular, but I've been meaning to since hearing you talking about it. Maybe I can get back to you. 24 hours.
Just the edge length. The edge length
or the. When you say edge length,
just expect. So are these.
The
total
length.
Not the total,
but
just the edges here too, right? What
else is
to see here? These are
just boxes. These are
So the curve is defined by a set of points. So
yeah, so it's a Fourier transform. Okay, so
in between the points, then
that wouldn't be the right thing to ask for. These aren't polygons. These are really curves.
Yeah.
Well, Jason model, I mean, the polygons they're not knots, right?
They could be knots.
Well,
these could also be not knots. Yeah. Right? These could be self-intersecting also. So I guess the question is what the analog of the this isn't a polygon. There's some. Since you're doing a Fourier thing, there's something that would be like the answer.
So you can look at, for example, the probability distribution of the curvature, the Frenet curvature, the probability distribution of the Frenet torsion. These are all questions that, in principle, with enough patience, can be directly extracted from this data. Correlation functions of the curvature. All of these things are directly accessible for these curves because on a small scale, they're smooth. And these pictures that Sammy showed show what the sort of smooth like behavior is if on that small scale. So, but then asking questions which you can ask about Jason's random polygons, just like Shura's and Ken's, is you say once they find that once you get to a typical large scale, which is larger than a characteristic length scale for the system in question, closed curves tend to be knotted rather than tend not to be knotted. And each system has this characteristic length scale, what Sandy was calling the half-life. And so one of the things we would like to know is whether that behavior that's been observed for all these different random curves that people have talked about before is true for these ones as well, but there's not yet enough data.
So one statistic that Shura focuses on, it's related to just take sort of the expected product of the tangent vectors. That would be the analog. So that would be the That's a quantity.
Yes. Well, and that's the quantity after which these things seem to be random curves, or roughly about the quantity these seem to be random curves. We haven't done any detailed analysis of trying to get bounds on that, but that's exactly the sort of thing that we are in the process of doing. Now, one of the things that using that quantity, which people normally use as a way of establishing a length scale along a random curve, you then say, well, how many of those does it take? How many of those is this half-life of being an unknot? But it seems that actually ensures that we've got all sort of stories about this, that it can vary by orders of magnitude depending upon the different sort of random model you're using to generate the knot. For example, if you're forcing yourself to be in the bonds of a Z3 lattice, then obviously that length has a rather different behavior from if you're growing something smooth with a sort of very small curvature smooth curve like this. And so a question which I thought was interesting to discuss in thinking about random knotting is an appropriate length scale for very, very long random curves really the half-life of being unknotted? And does all the larger scale structures, like the as Ken was talking in his talk about looking at the shape not just of the unknots, but say the trefoils, and you find trefoils and they grow and they peak and they decay. Look at figure eight knots, look at composites of two trefoils. You see all of them, there's a zero probability, it grows, but then as the length of the curves go to infinity, no knot type is preferred, so it all tends to zero. So asking about the shapes of those sorts of distributions and whether they're the same or different for these different models that people have discussed seems to be something that modern computer power is able to look at numerically now in a way that perhaps it couldn't have done 20 or 25 years ago or so, when DeWitt Summers and Stu Whittington first discovered this half-life phenomenon on a Z3 lattice.
Sandy, how big is zero?
What do you mean by zero?
What do you mean by zero?
What do you mean by zero?
You say you're looking for zeros of the phase.
No, the phase goes by 2 pi. The phase is undefined in the center, and it's a zero of intensity.
Zero of the order of parameters.
Yeah, fine. Zero. How big is zero?
Infinitesimally small. So if you were to look only, if you did it by intensity rather than the phase change, it's an absurd question almost. You can't really.
Are you asking how he finds the zeros, Randy?
Yeah.
So
you do it by doing the by doing winding.
Yeah. So if you.
Oh, you don't do it by looking for zero.
No.
Okay.
Although you can clarify that they always do follow the zeros, and you can check that.
Well, yeah, but because I'm wondering, if this were like a superconductor or superfluid, then the size of the hole, the size of the zero, would depend on other things,
mm-hmm.
right? And then you could ask, is the knot type independent of the cutoff? Right? Is there, if you make it thinner and thinner, do you see more and more knotting? Or not?
So that's exactly the sort of question that the Sandy's final question is. If you're going to go from looking at the linear case like these, where zeros really are infinitesimal zeros, to non-linear, and in non-linear systems, maybe these zeros will acquire some.
But they're all locally zeros.
But if you were to look at this in superfluid, then there is a core.
Unless it's not quantized. If you look at condensates, which are quantized, then...
But it depends then on the physics.
Wait. Condensates that are quantized, yes, finish the sentence.
So even if you look at the mean field approximation, right, you have a coherent field, mean field, which describes it. So the vortices are quantized.
Right, but dislocation, there's a hole.
Dislocation in phase is a point.
Sure, but the actual physical system as a whole.
Yeah, but a condensate has a finite.
It's a heating lens yes. Which defines the size of a hole.
That's right.
Yeah. But you can pinpoint the defect.
Yeah, but in this case, that's the point of being linear. When it's linear, the zero really is
right.
An infinitesimally right. Wide line. But we know it's smooth on a small scale.
Right.
So that was the first question that in the earlier work we did is sort of, is there a near continuum of really tiny little loops that we just don't resolve? But no, it scales nicely, and Sandy's data matches the expectation with this crossover very clean. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, Sandy, you still expect some questions. I was hoping that this would become some sort of discussion on that we could talk about random knots, because I think that different people here have different ideas of random knots. What we've been kind of specific system in mind, and we've been looking at comparing with the sorts of systems that have been inspired by Shura and Ken and the sorts of things they look at. But I know that there are different sorts of meanings of random knots.
Inverting the problem, I don't think it's a hard. It may not be relevant, isn't it? But if you have, you know, one of the random knots generated by, for example, the procedure case where you're actually taking a polygon and orbiting around, and you get something in your family of things that you could, well, not only approximate, you might want to create a series because they're just continuous curves. Maybe there's a Gibbs phenomenon or something, but you get some distribution then of your AKs.
Right, I mean,
these are
random Fourier series of actual waves, and you could look at random Lissajous curves, which is something that Shura himself has done.
Well, I don't want to do random, I want to hit the limits. I mean, one of the games I just did to Jason was, you can think of his theory as a theory for the derivative being an L2, so I mean, you've got square integral, he takes the edges, he's made it got something that's just like, periodic object. You play that game. It's getting kind of mathematical, but you could ask about how his distribution of Fourier transforms here. If it's the same distribution, I mean, the guess is it might be. If you think the limit is the number of edges goes to infinity in this picture, that leads to the notion of kind of a
So I'd say that the dream of the physics of looking at these sorts of systems is that what we're really interested in doing is seeing whether this conjecture for random eigenfunctions, so I'm looking at an eigenfunction of a system like the three torus, or like or take a chaotic system, a sort of chaotic cavity, like the shape of this room. Well, we're going to look at the complex eigenfunctions inside this room. There's a conjecture of Michael Berry that says that the eigenfunctions, when you look at the very high energy limit, look like these random superpositions of type waves. So one of the games that people play is they find some rather exotic statistic such as the unknotting half-life, and then ask, is that the same for real eigenfunctions that are numerically computed in the very high energy limit against these Gaussian random functions, because it seems to be a remarkably robust statement that random eigenfunctions or high eigenfunctions of deterministic systems look like random eigenfunctions. So, and no one's got really good ideas on how to tackle that. So thinking about population was one of the ways about 10 years ago that people thought of to try and tackle this problem. But no one's really got a good mathematical handle.
Are there other zeros in that picture?
In this picture, this is just a picture of one light. I can show you a whole box if you like.
No. You found these by looking where the phase wound.
Yeah.
So are there zeros where the phase doesn't wind?
No.
How do you know?
I just know.
I know they're not generic, but I'm
So this random model only samples what's generic.
Yeah, I understand. I'm just asking you.
So if there are, I don't know about it. That's the best I can.
Okay. All right. So you didn't look for those.
No.
But given that your method will pick up where the phase is, if there was something very funny in the phase pattern, it would have flagged up as a problem.
I'm not thinking that. I'm thinking there are places where it's non-generic.
Even if you have such places.
Yeah, the amplitude is zero.
Well, it's just zero by accident.
Yeah.
But can it be zero by accident and have no, the phase is inherently undefined on, if both the real and imaginary components are zero? Or do you know how to divide
by zero? That's the exact reconnection.
Yeah, which is co-dimensional in form.
So it's not very common. Okay.
Yeah, so it would be common if you were to, which is what Sandy was showing with this analytic picture, that if you were to vary an additional parameter, like imagine this is experiment, I'm going to trim one of the dials, that then these small zip loops could shrink to zero, and that they are your funny points, but you don't see those funny points stable. You just see this scaling.
So even where you can get those points, you can. If you look through the data, you can find where the lines approach very closely, but the probability of finding them actually intersect and have something funny is negligible, if not arguably zero.
Well, maybe we should thank you, Sandy, again for that. And we've talked a lot about this particular way of random and not. I mean, I don't know if anybody here would like to suggest anything or say anything about other systems in Anton, do you?
But did you plan it? Because we are out of time.
Well, we can, I mean, there are cookies in 5 minutes.
Cookies and watermelon.
But do you want to say a few words, Anton?
Yeah, I had about 10 minutes or something to ask questions.
So you can quietly speak for 10 minutes and we'll give the other guys a run on the cookies.
Everybody is smart.
Can I just disconnect them?
I had 5 minutes before, and I thought I'll add a few more words from in this discussion, because I mentioned how we got some vortex knots spontaneously in nonlinear medium. So I was talking about the nonlinear Schrödinger equation, which is going to use.
Do we have to give up the room?
No.
No.
You left it on you?
Yeah, I still got it.
Are you guys saying embarrassing things?
Yeah, so...
You'll have to watch to find it.
Yeah.
Lasers thing?
No, it's
really
something.
Okay. So this is an nonlinear Schrödinger equation, and the difference from what Andy talked today is that we start with, initially I'm not having a randomness, I start with a Gaussian beam, and then spontaneously, this is linear Gaussian in linear medium, nothing happens in Christian, but in nonlinear medium, we've got spontaneous generation of a vortex, which in this simple case, when we have a soliton propagating, a laser beam propagating in a linear medium, we perturb it a little bit by stretching. We have this spontaneous appearance of vortex rings, and in other cases, vortex spirals. And in general, when we have both perturbation, we observe the spontaneous formation of vortex links and knots. So here is the example which I showed before, and it's chosen carefully just to show how the single parameter we have, we can generate a family of different torus knots. But what I left out from this picture is that in general, in reality, we have the picture is more complex, and we usually have something like that. I don't know if you can see it very well. So the colors are not very very good here, because this blue is trefoil, this red is Hopfling, while this blue is it's just an unknot, and green lines are go out of the box. So starting from initially smooth conditions, I don't have here any parameters to define the randomness, yet they look quite irregular. And so next, I can show you what I know and what I don't know about this system, and what I would like to know. So what I know is that we can find similar solutions if we analyze our system, our dynamics of a soliton interacting with small perturbation. And because the soliton is radially symmetric, and the perturbation is small, linearizing the system, I got the Lyapunov stability analysis with the potential which is radially symmetric. In cylindrical coordinates, I introduce a zipf-ball harmonics, and then what I see is the eigenvalue problem coupling harmonics with the same zipf-ball index. And this integer index is, of course, what we call Bolzhikov charge of a vortex, and defines the orbital angular momentum. But this is a vortex in the perturbation mode. To find the actual vortex lines, I have to solve the equation, again, find zeros of the field. So I didn't get this argument, what's the difference with nonlinear case, because this is a nonlinear case, and but the field is coherent. And so the phase, singularities, dislocations in the phase from defined vortices very well, and so what with my symmetries, that's my equation. And it works very well, although with the growth of index to find these modes numerically, it's more and more difficult, although it's technical difficulty, it is there. The system is non-integrable, so this is the inval of a soliton. What I know about it is that it has exponential tail, but there is no expression or some sort of, it's all done numerically. But it works. At least for some parameter set, we could identify and find the periodic solution which corresponds to all the knots we observe in direct numerics. So the first question I asked last time is that I know how to find them for specific parameters. What I don't know is how to define a parameter domain where those reconnections happen, and I have knots or I don't have knots. A little bit more about this particular realization when I have only two harmonics, a perturbation harmonic zero and a second order, is actually a quadratic equation, and I can find a solution on the torus. And also what I find from here, what I know, is that changing the parameters of a soliton, I could find also higher order knots within the same approximation. So how come that in my direct numerics, I see this appearance of, if not random, but irregular knots? Well, the answer probably is that I have to look for many more modes, so not only two, but higher order perturbation modes, and then for each mode I have this eigenvalue, and I have two complex parameters, so of course the parametric space grows very quickly, and I cannot say much about it. So in principle, I should be able to just project my initial state to this space of perturbation harmonics and then solve, again, the same equation. The randomness here in real life, an experiment, would come from a random perturbation. But what I'm asking is, or trying to formulate the question, actually looking for a good question, is that when I have this insight in the dynamics, can I identify or explain why not happens? they're not topological, what occurred, the expression here, in the sense that there is no need for them to appear. So how do I characterize my physical process or fun physical process which gives me that, and I need to find a way how to characterize it. Asking how, so I had this question before, what is the probability of not appearing? Well, if I don't perturb it enough, the probability is zero. But if I just have a random initial conditions, they do appear. So this is my question. Thank you.
Sorry, sir.
No other question. OK, thanks.
Guys, do the linear theory, so I've got some not one thing, superpose it to another one, get a new field. There's no relation whatsoever. In the nonlinear, there's no superposition. I'm just wondering, what. I'm not sure where to go with
that. Right, so the point of this random superposition is to ask what knots are typical. Now, obviously, if I change any of my parameters, I'm going to change the particular conformation and the particular topology. But nevertheless, the statistical properties of the distribution ought to be remain.
That's sort of what I'm getting at. That we can.
So it's an idea of what is the sort of equilibrium topology, and these are sort of equilibrium distributions.
Right. So now I'm going to ask the question. So what's the analog of that kind of statistical field of just ordinary linear superposition?
Here it comes down to explanation of your system, because you see this distribution is linear, but so I just on the free series here. But in reality, what
my equation?
This is one way to describe it. It gives a different side because this gives you periodic solution. That's not what I observe in reality. So my question is, how do I analyze reality if I have this understanding where they come from? And of course, you call it geometric nonlinearity when you have one knot and you have superposition fields.
So sort of, what's the space of all solutions to your equation? What's the natural measure on it that would let you do the sort of statistics that you're doing as well? Linear superposition.
I could take the same random superposition, so I could modulate those alphas and betas initially and then look for probability. But this is for this linear system, and when they talk about speckle field, it's kind of natural. For me, it's a little bit different because I can start with the smooth conditions. I don't have anything random, and then they appear to be random. Why? Because during the propagation, initially I excite somewhat, and then the nonlinear dynamics kicks in, breaks the symmetry, and they're not sure why. So it's a different mechanism, I think. This is just a model. So I could do numerics, just adding random noise here, some random function, just but similar random function as saying that, but that wouldn't be much different, I think. Mm. If I just stay within this approximation, if I plug it into nonlinear equation and solve it here, that's different. So I'm happy to show any more details or if you have any questions, but I was hoping to ask questions more. Because I left out a lot of physics, which is probably not. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.